This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Two U.S. Senate committees issued a joint report Tuesday detailing a number of intelligence and security failures ahead of and during the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The report called the attack on a Capitol building an attack on democracy, said that those responsible for protecting the building complex were not prepared for a large-scale attack despite it, and said being aware of the potential for violence targeting the Capitol. The U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Rules Committees launched their bipartisan investigation in February, hearing testimony from the heads of the U.S. Capitol Police and other law enforcement agencies, as well as current and former officials from the Defense Department and Department of Homeland Security. The committee said they also reviewed thousands of documents and received written statements from 50 U.S. Capitol Police officers. The report went on to say that the intelligence community failed to properly analyze, assess, and disseminate to law enforcement the potential for violence that day. The attack came as lawmakers inside the Capitol were meeting to certify President Joe Biden's election victory. Supporters of former President Donald Trump violently broke through security lines and stormed to the Capitol building. Members of Congress rushed to safety, returning hours later to finish their work. The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly approved legislation aiming to boost semiconductor production in the U.S. The bill is a bid to protect economic and national security in the face of growing international competition, most notably from China. The centerpiece of the bill is a $50 billion emergency allotment to the Commerce Department to stand up semiconductor development and manufacturing through research and incentive programs previously authorized by Congress. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The head of UNAIDS is now told a high-level meeting of the UN General Assembly Tuesday that inequalities are a chief driver of the HIV-AIDS epidemic, just as they are with COVID-19, saying that those inequalities include power, status, rights, and voice inequalities, killing. As she said, nations must end the inequalities that perpetuate HIV/AIDS if they want to meet their target of ending the epidemic by 2030. Since the first cases were reported 40 years ago, UNAIDS says 77.5 million people have been infected with HIV and nearly 35 million have died from AIDS. Also saying the COVID-19 pandemic has shown how political will can help push science, saying that the same sort of push needs to be made for HIV/AIDS treatments, prevention, care, and vaccines. UN member states adopted a political declaration on scaling up progress in order to reach the 2030 goal, but it was not without some controversy. Just before the adoption, Russia's representative tried to get the assembly to agree 3 months to three amendments, which would have eliminated language on respecting the human rights of persons living with HIV/AIDS and ending discriminatory and restrictive laws based on a person's HIV status. The amendments were overwhelmingly voted down, the original draft text. The result of lengthy negotiations and compromises among member states was adopted with 165 votes in favor, 4 against, and no country abstaining. A number of major websites went down Tuesday because of an outage at the cloud services company Fastly. The affected sites included news agency CNN, The Guardian, and The New York Times, streaming platform Twitch, and the British government website. All were back online with a period of hours. The outage is also forcing CNN's website offline in the Asian cities of Hong Kong and Singapore. There was little mention of the outage on social media platforms in China, where most foreign media websites are permanently blocked. While coronavirus infection rates and hospitalizations continue to plummet across the United States, the White House COVID-19 response team said that the Delta variant strain of the virus that causes the disease still poses a threat, particularly among younger people. During the response team's regular virtual news briefing, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Rochelle Walensky told reporters that the latest daily average of new cases fell by 30% over the past week and 90% since the start of the year. She said it was also the lowest daily average since March of last year. More at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 9, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon separatists welcome U.S. visa restrictions, but say it does not go far enough.
I was hoping that they will confiscate the assets of people in Cameroon. They have bank accounts here. They have houses here. The government could show more seriousness by confiscating those assets. And then, I believe, the Cameroon government would really begin to talk.
Zambian police questioned and released with warning the leader of striking medical doctors. Zimbabwe rejects donation of COVID-19 vaccine amid shortages. Kenya looks to maintain a zero rhino poaching record. And Liberia hosts a judicial conference amid criticism of corruption in the justice system.
It is time for us to begin to act so that those who seek justice will see an independent judiciary withstanding the power of the executive and the power of the legislature.
And World Ocean Day is celebrated with a warning. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesperson for Cameroon separatists said the imposition of visa restrictions on individuals in Cameroon by the United States is a step in the right direction, but did not go far enough. Chris Anun, the Secretary of State for Communications of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia, says the separatists had hoped that the restrictions would include seizure of the assets belonging to certain Cameroon government officials here in the United States. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said he was imposing the visa restrictions on individuals who are believed to be responsible or complicit in undermining the peaceful resolution of the nearly five-year-old conflict in Cameroon's Anglophone regions. He said the decision reflects U.S. commitment to advance a dialogue to peacefully resolve the crisis and support respect for human rights. Spokesperson Anun says the separatists have always advocated for dialogue as embodied in the Swiss negotiation process.
When you look at the toll of people who have died in this struggle, and you look at the humanitarian situation too, back in Cameroon, it is so bad to just say, let's stop them from coming to America. I think that, again, is a good step, but not far enough to leave any impact on the officials who are standing on the way to a resolution of the conflict in Cameroon. I was hoping that they will confiscate the assets of people in Cameroon like Paul Atangenji, like John Ngute, like Paul Tasson. They have bank accounts here. They have houses here. They have businesses here. The government could be more serious, show more seriousness by confiscating those assets. And then I believe the Cameroon government would really begin to talk.
Chris, I'm not sure if the announcement said who the restrictions will impact. I'm thinking that maybe the restrictions refer to both the Cameroon government and your movement.
Well, our movement, James, has advocated for dialogue again and again. We have indicated our readiness anytime, any day to sit down and dialogue. So to suggest that that applies to us doesn't make sense, because we are not obstructionists. We are not fighting against negotiations. We have been talking to the Swiss, who are like the mediators here. The Cameroon government has not been talking to the Swiss. They are the one obstructing the Swiss process. So I just do not think it should apply to us by any means.
As you mentioned, this conflict is going on now for almost 5 years. You say you are interested in dialogue, but how come we haven't seen any movement along those lines?
Well, James, it takes two people to dialogue. The other party here is La République du Cameroun. And we are the other parties. So if we are ready in La République du Cameroun isn't ready, what do we do? Maybe you should ask that question to the Swiss, who are the mediators. Ask them who is standing on the way, who is obstructing. The Swiss will tell you it isn't the Ambazonians. It is the Republic of Cameroon. We are ready for dialogue even tomorrow. But La République du Cameroun isn't.
Would you like the U.S. government involvement in the dialogue process?
We would appreciate any international party's involvement in the dialogue process. I think it's a good thing. However, we would like to go with what the Swiss have put on the table, which everybody else, including the U.S., have endorsed.
You said it takes two to tango. I think we cannot see the end of the tunnel because on one hand, it seems to me you and the Cameroon government are not seeing eye to eye in terms of what's the centerpiece for negotiation. You want independent Ambazonia, and the Cameroon government does not want that.
Well, James, the international prescription for the negotiation says looking back or going back to the root causes. The word independence, yes, is there, but we're essentially looking at the root causes. When both parties sit on the table with the mediators, they will look into the root causes, and the root causes will then determine the direction of the negotiation.
Chris, it's always very nice to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. You're speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. A four-day national judicial conference has opened in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, under the theme, The Law, Public Policy, and the Economy. As Moses Gaziowu reports from Monrovia, Chief Justice Francis Corpoy said the rule of law is fundamental to peace and national security.
The conference is being attended by judges, lawyers, financial and development experts. They are deliberating on what organizers are calling the current reality in the implementation of the rule of law in Liberia. Chief Justice Francis Corpoy, in his opening remarks, reminded legal stakeholders that the rule of law is the cornerstone of democracy.
The rule of law is the cornerstone of democracy, and democracy is strongly interlinked to development. There is consensus that democratic governance established through competitive, free and fair elections creates a stable environment in which businesses can thrive and the economy can flourish.
Justice Corpoy also says the rule of law is fundamental to all public policy decisions.
All public policy decisions must be taken with the law or rule of law as a guiding principle to avoid arbitrariness. The rule of law is fundamental to national and international peace and security and political stability.
The Liberian judiciary has been criticized as corrupt and lacking integrity, an allegation that the court itself has denied. The president of the National Bar Association, Tiawon Gonglo, has called for independence of the judiciary.
It is time for us to begin to act so that those who seek justice will see an independent judiciary withstanding the power of the executive and the power of the legislature in the interest of all those who seek justice.
Councillor Gonglo said if decisions are taken by justice actors under common law and respected by other actors, it will help restore confidence in the justice system of Liberia. United States Ambassador to Liberia Michael McCarthy said prosperity and sustainable development can only be attracted to Liberia with proper judicial system.
Prosperity and sustainable development in Liberia rest on this country's encourage local entrepreneurship and maintain a tax system that is fair and effective. This is impossible without strong jurisprudence and without a zero-tolerance policy towards corruption in all its forms.
Ambassador McCarthy said achieving those goals requires a multi-sectoral approach that includes the Temple of Justice, Ministry of Justice, the Legislature, Civil Society, and the Liberian National Bar Association. He cautioned the institutions to resist any of these stakeholders who may want to set the country backward.
All play essential roles. They should be forces of good. And if one stakeholder tries to move the country backward, others should resist and stand for what's right.
Meanwhile, the government of Liberia says it has embedded in its development agenda issues relating to the rule of law. Liberian Justice Minister Frank Musa then said the rule of law contributes to lasting peace and development.
Increase in the number and capacity of public prosecutors, judges, public defenders, legal aid practitioners, corrections officials, social workers, and the construction of several courthouse buildings.
Swedish Ambassador to Liberia Ingrid Vetterquist says the judiciary has a role in bringing about accountability for crimes committed during the Liberian Civil War. She said her country is concerned about the use of donor resources in the absence of war and economic crimes court in Liberia.
As donors, We are, of course, concerned about the use of resources of your country, as we are as regards the obstacles that have been left in your way by the legacy of the Civil War. And my question is, how much of this can be dealt within the legal system? How much can you embrace the need for your country to lay this to rest, to move forward into the future? We wish to be partners in this.
Part 1 of Rule 19 of the revised rules of the Supreme Court provides that the Supreme Court shall hold a national judicial conference at least once every year to discuss pertinent issues affecting society. But the court is hosting its fourth conference after 10 years. Moses Dazo, VOA News, Monrovia.
Zambian police said Tuesday that they questioned and released the president of the Resident Doctors Association, Dr. Brian Sampa. Police spokesperson Esther Katongo says Dr. Sampa was warned for inciting persons employed in the provision of essential services contrary to the Industrial and Labor Relations Act of Zambia. She says the alleged offense took place between May 12 and June 2021 in Lusaka. The doctors are on strike because they say the government has refused to meet their demands for payment of arrears, as well as employ 500 additional doctors to ease their workload. But the government says the doctors cannot go on strike because they are considered essential employees. Police spokesperson Katongo says Dr. Sampa was cautioned for inciting essential employees and released.
What I can confirm is that our officers at police headquarters did summon Dr. Brian Sampa, who is a medical doctor. And he was warned and cautioned for inciting persons who are employed in the provisions of essential services, in this case, other doctors. And this is according to our laws here in Zambia. It is contrary to the Industrial and Labor Relations Act. Then it is alleged that he committed the same offense between 12th of May 2021 and the 31st June 2021. But as I already stated, nothing much happened apart from the warning and caution. This is a matter which is still under investigation. And after he was warned and cautioned, he was left to go home as police continue finding facts in this same matter.
My understanding is Dr. Sampa had already been dismissed. Why did you feel necessary for you to invite him to the headquarters?
The dismissal is not our issue as the police. For us as police, ours is law enforcement. So if we suspect that someone had committed an offense, our role is to investigate that matter and deal with it in the criminal manner.
Another issue I wanted to ask you, the issue of whether there was a plan to assassinate the opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema. What can you tell us about that?
You know, as Zambia, we are in an election. And usually when we are in a year of elections, we hear a lot of allegations, a lot of false statements being peddled. And one such statement is something to do with assassinations. This is not the first time that the UPND opposition leader is claiming that there have been attempts to have him assassinated. Talking about where he's claiming to say that police officers wanted to assassinate him, there was nothing like use of live ammunition by our police officers. All our officers who were on the ground policing on that particular day, they were armed with riot guns, and all they discharged were a tear gas canisters, was tear smoke. So there was no one on the ground who was armed with a firearm, not even with rubber bullets. We only had riot guns. That's what the officers were using. So we don't even know the firearm that was discharged, where it hit after it missed him, if those are his claims. Otherwise, there was nothing like that, and these are just political statements. And people should understand that we are in a political, in an election year, and the political leaders can allege anything.
We understand that there are no mass rallies during the political campaign. How are you dealing with that?
Generally, when you look at what is prevailing on the ground, we have recorded higher levels of compliance from political parties when it comes to conducting of political activities in public places.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much.
The pleasure is ours. Thank you so much.
Zambian police spokesperson Esther Katongo was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 9. Zimbabwe's government is facing criticism for turning down a donation of 3 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. Authorities say they are not prepared to deal with the refrigeration requirements and possible side effects. But critics also point to politics as the reason behind the government's decision. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
In a letter to the African Export-Import Bank, Zimbabwe's government explained it was still analyzing possible side effects of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine. Finance Minister Secretary George Gwamatanga also said the country does not have storage facilities required for the doses. But in an interview, Dr. Norman Matara from the Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights said Johnson & Johnson vaccines are stored at the same temperatures as China's Sinopharm and Sinovac vaccines, which Zimbabwe has been using since February.
So we already have those cold chain mechanisms to store vaccines at 2 to 8 degrees, which the Johnson & Johnson is supposed to be stored. So it doesn't make sense to say they don't have the cold chain reactions. In addition, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is given as a one dose. So actually the cost of rolling out that vaccine is much less than the Sinopharm and Sinovac. And also the logistics of one dose is much better than the two dose provided by Sinopharm. So we do not get it why they would reject those vaccines.
The African Union set up the deal in which the African Export-Import Bank would pay for 220 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines. Zimbabwe was to receive 3 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that were manufactured in Britain. Harare-based political commentator Rejoice Ngwenya said that poor relations between Zimbabwe and Britain are the real reason the Zimbabwean government is rejecting the donation.
It is a tragedy that the government of Zimbabwe is rejecting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Why is the London Harare diplomatic chief being allowed to interfere in a process where the citizens of this country are under threat? I really think that the ZANU-PF government should desist from politicizing these issues and get out of its arrogance to ensure that the safety and the security of citizens of Zimbabwe is safeguarded. I think this is a tragedy and it should be reversed, I think, with immediate effect.
Relations between London and Harare have been strained since 2002 when Britain imposed travel and financial sanctions on Zimbabwe's officials for human rights abuses and alleged election rigging. On Tuesday, Dr. John Mangwiro, Zimbabwe's junior health minister, refused to comment on the alleged political motivations and reiterated that Zimbabwe will continue to use Chinese and Russian vaccines. He says, so we'll stick to what we are used to, such as Sinopharm and Russia's Sputnik. They are stored at temperatures between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius. Plus, once they are injected into a person, their weakened or deactivated viruses in them trigger protective immunity. That's how we choose which vaccines to use here, he said. Zimbabwe says it still has stocks of the 1.7 million vaccines it has received from China, Russia, and India since February. But for weeks now, most places have run dry of the jab. That resulted in a protest last week at the country's main vaccination center in the capital. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Kenya's wildlife service says that for the first time in 21 years, not a single rhinoceros was poached in the country's national parks in 2020. To maintain the progress, Kenya is conducting the first ever wildlife census and placing mobile container housing in parks for rangers. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's Wildlife Service credits intensified surveillance for the drop in the rhinoceros poaching cases to zero last year, the lowest number in two decades. The agency says it's also taking fresh measures to maintain the progress, such as conducting a wildlife census for the first time. Edwin Wanyonyi is the agency's director of strategies.
There's a new strategy in the entire KWS that we're focusing on housing for rangers. We are focusing on buying them new equipment. Be it the firearms, whatever they require, be it the uniforms, be it cold weather clothing, that they can be able to respond at all times.
In Nairobi National Park, rangers with the rhinoceros monitoring unit are receiving upgrades from old tents. Ranger Augustine Mutua says new container housing units will help them get to work protecting rhinos much faster.
You have to wake up there in the morning, you cook the breakfast, then you just walk out, going direct to the patrol. Not as the earlier as we are doing. You come out of the tent, you go outside to fetch water somewhere. You can see the tank there.
More than 2 million tourists visited Kenya in 2019. Most, like Rahul Bid, go to see its rare wildlife like the critically endangered rhinos.
It's great that there's been no poaching. This park is very well protected, which I'd say other parks are not as well protected.
Poachers kill rhinos for their horns, which sell for up to $60,000 per kilogram in Asian markets as aphrodisiacs and status symbols. Poaching reduced Kenya's black rhinos population by 97% from the 1960s to the 1990s, from more than 20,000 to just a few hundred. But conservation efforts have helped Kenya's wild rhino population recover to 1,200, some including the world's only two remaining northern white rhinos. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
As they marked World Ocean Day yesterday, Tuesday, the World Meteorological Organization warns that the continued rise of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is threatening the ecosystems of the world's oceans. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Carbon dioxide, the primary greenhouse gas emitted from human activities, is the key driver of global warming. Scientists say CO2 emissions hang around in the atmosphere for a very long time, from 300 to 1,000 years. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says because of this long lifetime, rising emissions of CO2 will have a profound impact on future generations.
Not just talking about one or two, we're talking about many generations will be committed to seeing more impacts of climate change. So that means rising temperatures, more extreme weather, melting ice, rising sea level, and all the associated impacts.
The ocean absorbs around 23% of the annual atmospheric emissions of carbon dioxide and acts as a buffer against climate change. Latest data from the Atmospheric Monitoring Station in Hawaii, the Mauna Loa Observatory, find a considerable rise in CO2 emissions in May compared to those in previous years. Nullis says this is causing ocean acidification, a phenomenon that will have a very serious impact on ocean ecosystems.
This has obviously a very damaging effect on marine ecosystem systems, coral reefs. The ocean also absorbs 90% of the excess heat from human activities, and as a result, ocean heat is at a record level, and large parts of the ocean are seeing heat waves every year.
A recent report by two UN agencies notes at least 25% of the world's live coral has been lost in the last three decades due to ocean acidification and marine heat waves. If the trend continues, the agencies warn it could lead to the loss of functional coral reef ecosystems around most of the world by mid-century. That has huge consequences as coral reefs provide essential habitat for 25% of all marine life, estimated at well over 1 million species. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's it for this Wednesday, June 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botte in Washington saying, have a great day.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo. Coming up on the science edition of Press Conference USA, experts from Johns Hopkins Medicine will give us an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, talk about its impact on our mental health, and how we can prepare ourselves to resume our lives in a post-pandemic world. That's the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Listen for it this Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.